Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guests today are Darsha Narvaez and Four Arrows. Darsha Narvaez is Professor Emerita of Psychology at the University of Notre Dame, Indiana, USA. She's a fellow of the American Psychological Association, the American Educational Research Association, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. She studies moral development and human flourishing from an interdisciplinary perspective, integrating anthropology, neuroscience, clinical developmental, and educational sciences. She has published hundreds of papers and over 20 books, including the multi-award-winning book, Neurobiology and the Development of Human Morality, Evolution, Culture, and Wisdom. She serves as president of kindredworld.org and hosts the webpage evolvenest.org. Wahingpa Topa, Four Arrows, a.k.a. Don Trent Jacobs, self-identifies as Irish Cherokee, but follows the spiritual path of the Oglala Lakota as a maid relative of and sun dancer with the medicine horse Teos Pava. He lived and worked on the Pine Ridge Reservation, a director of education at Oglala Lakota College. Currently at Fielding Graduate University's School of Leadership Studies, he's authored 21 books and numerous other publications on applications of our original nature-based worldview. AERO selected him as one of 27 visionaries in education, and he's the recipient of Martin Springer Institute Moral Courage Award for his activism. He lives with his artist wife in Mexico, where he surfs, plays handball, rides horses, and plays gypsy jazz on the keyboard. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Great to be here.
So can you both tell me about your new book, Restoring the Kinship Worldview, Indigenous Voices Introduce 28 Precepts for Rebalancing Life on Planet Earth?
Well, I know Darsha always says that just because I'm that lead author, as we say in the academy, that she always asks me to go first. Maybe we'll get to change that next time, Darsha. I had put a query out to a publisher, North Atlantic Books, about a book called The Words of Sitting Bull for a World in Crisis, feeling that Sitting Bull really represented the Lakota thoughts that are happening today with people that I sun dance with. And it's a sort of a hopelessness, Derek. It's looking at Vaclav Havel's idea of hope, that hope is not the certainty of an outcome, but the certainty that whatever you're doing is the right thing, regardless of the outcome. And that certainly was the world that Sitting Bull lived in. But he never stopped being a human being, singing his songs, resisting, doing the work you're doing, Derek, etc. But somebody else picked it up. That was a friend of an editor, and I hadn't heard from NAB, so I went ahead and published that book under a different publisher. And then the next, just after it got accepted as a contract, NAB finally got back to me, and I said, "Oh man, I'm so sorry, but I got someone else. It was so long since I heard from you," and it just came out of me. "But would you like a similar book? And instead of just quoting Sitting Bull, I'll quote lots of indigenous folks and do a similar thing." And they said, "Yeah." And right away, I just decided, I don't want to do this again without Darsha. We have done we've worked together in the past, and I thought that would make it, not such a lonely task. And so I called her up and said, we got the book contract, are you go for it? And she said, yeah. And we did it because we both have been talking about and working on the assumption that we're missing the baseline of how humans can be. And that baseline is how we lived for most of human history up until around 9,000 years ago, as in a nature-oriented nature, using that as our guide for how to go through this complex, dynamic, chaos world and wind up with sustainable results. So that is, Darsha, what you can take it from there.
Well, I've been on this journey for maybe a shorter time than Four Arrows, although I do have indigenous blood in me and multicultural blood, being a Puerto Rican and German American. But I discovered through science, through the processes of science, also theology, where we should be as a human species. It's, we forgot who we are. We forgot what human nature looks like when properly and sustainably and supportively is raised, and what thriving looks like in human beings, and what that means for being a member of the Earth community. And so that's my journey, has just kind of pulled the pieces together, and from neuroscience and clinical science and all the evidence we have really is transdisciplinary. But we can see that our native cousins, ancestors had this wisdom. They didn't need all the research studies, right? They lived it. And that's what the book's about. It's about taking the quotes of this wisdom that was lived for generations, for eons, and now bringing it back and knitting together what we know from science and what we know from education, and how to get back to that indigenous or kinship worldview.
And it's interesting, Derek, that in our dialogues, after we found 28, Darsha took half and I took half, 28 oratories of really powerful speeches of indigenous people from around the world, both the deceased and still with us. And then Darsha and I dialogue, and, you know, Darsha mentioned several times about using science and education. And we're really frank with each other in our dialogue. And sometimes we disagree. I sometimes will refer to the research that I've done in books like Critical Neurophilosophy and Indigenous Wisdom, that scientists and educators very often have seen through the lens of the dominant worldview in ways that disagree with conclusions that indigenous worldview offers. And so we've been very open in our using of our different experiences to help flush out and help the reader understand the message, the ultimate message of each of the 28 worldviews. Yeah, I've got chihuahuas out in the back. I thought those were mine for just a second.
That's dogs here barking at probably a bear on the porch.
I love it. That's actually a good thing, since what we're talking about is really about recognizing the wisdom and sentience and other than humans, or as David Abrams says, greater than humans.
Yeah.
So I have a few directions we could go. One of them is, would you like to highlight a couple of the quotes and discuss them? Or would you rather talk about sort of the foundations? What is the fundamental difference that you see between between a kinship perspective or kinship worldview and a more Western worldview or scientific worldview, or would you rather discuss the word worldview itself?
Well, I could read a couple of paragraphs from one of the chapters. I'll just open it sort of at random and see what it comes up to. Okay, I came to chapter 23, or worldview precept 23, and this is from a Rarámuri, also known as Tarahumara, Enrique Salmon, and it's called Connection to the Land. And it's probably synchronistic that I opened to this, because the Rarámuri Cimarrón people were who I lived with after I had a near-death experience that brought me to a vision about the importance of indigenous worldview. So he says that the Rarámuri view themselves as an integral part of the life and place within which they live. There is among the Rarámuri a concept called Iwigara, which encompasses many ideas and ways of thinking unique to place which with we live. Ritual and ceremony, the language, and therefore our thoughts are influenced by the land, animals, and winds with which we live. It is the total interconnectedness and integration of all life in the Sierra Madres, physical and spiritual. To say this word calls on that person to realize in all of its forms what life is. The person recalls the beginning of our origins, the relationship to animals, plants, the place of nurturing, and the entities to which the Rarotonga look for guidance. And so Darsha located that quote. And anything you want to say about that, Darsha?
It's so central to just the whole worldview of the kinship or indigenous perspective, the centrality of nature, that we're rooted in the natural world and we are members and partners with the natural world. It's just, I think, just marvelous.
Yes, and, you know, we write in our dialogue, you know, if you've been raised in the nature is dangerous atmosphere, you know, or uncomfortable, you know, it takes some effort to move away from the corresponding ignorance and fear about that. And we talk about that. And of course, there are other chapters on spirituality where, you know, examples are given. We close with the paragraph that this one of us that I think I close this one saying, concentric ecology requires experience relating to the land and other than humans as partners. It seems that we need a concerted educational effort aimed at both adults and children about how humans affect nature and nature affects humans, as Salman says. Most industrialized people seem to have forgotten their interdependency, despite the fact that their spiritual, physical, social, and mental health depends on the ability to live harmonious with the natural world. The dominant culture makes us into dumb and numb robopaths instead of full concentric human beings coexisting, connected, and respectfully with the living earth. We can restore our true connected nature by using the practices that are referenced in this book. Well, that'll give you a sense, as Darsha says, to the one of the central ideas that are in the 40 precepts. But it's really important to note that the worldview, and we'll talk about, I hope, in a minute, why we claim that there are only two worldviews, and that cultures, religions, philosophies, ideologies, these all can be grouped under either the dominant worldview and its many diverse cultures and religions, or under the indigenous worldview and its many diverse cultures and spiritual traditions.
One of the, there's a new book out that just came out, I started to read, by Marshall Solins, and we would have cited it if it had come out earlier before our book was in the works. It's called The New Science of the Enchanted Universe, An Anthropology of Most of Humanity. And he criticizes anthropology for having this kind of transcendental perspective that they interpret everyone else's culture other than the Euro-American view as strange and unusual. They believe this and they believe that. And he says that's most of humanity has this sense of integrated spiritual and non-spiritual aspects of the universe. And that's part of the indigenous perspective. You don't separate things. They're all integrated. And we're all part of this dynamic, spiritual, manifest, unmanifest world or universe. And to honor that is part of what we're trying to do in this book.
You know, and that's exactly the definition of worldview. Even with the German Immanuel Kant, who really first coined the word, it was about those two things, the relationship between humans and nature, and the relationship between humans and what we might call spirituality. And it's those differences that define the deeper idea of worldview. But you know, you had mentioned about how he has said how anthropologists and archaeologists in the past have, you know, kind of just said, no, ours is better. You know, in my University of Texas Press book, Unlearning the Language of Conquest, about scholars who are identifying anti-Indianism in America, they go even further. You know, you've got people from Lawrence Keeley, for example, from Oxford University, saying that, you know, civilian massacres by Indians prove that humanity is a product of civilization, and that centralized governments that overcame the horrors of primitive life are to be, you know, and, you know, UCLA anthropologist Robert Edgerton, child abuse and other social maladies were far more pervasive in primitive societies than in ours and proved the superiority of Western culture. And so, you know, this anti-Indianism it continues to either make us invisible or to diminish or ignore. But Darcy and I are finding out with the response to this book, Restoring Our Kinship Worldview, people are starting to wake up and say, wow, you know, none of these other things, the technologies, the sciences, they're not working. Maybe we should look into this.
And so my work is pointing out, and what I integrate in the book, is how important early life experience is and how we forgot how to raise children. And so we end up with aggressive and self-centered and, you know, dysregulated adults because their neurobiology, the way their brain functions, their stress response functions, their immune system, all the systems are dysregulated, misaligned, underdeveloped. And you end up with these very triggering people who are easily triggered into, you know, feeling angry or scared or panicking, and they don't think very well because the blood flow shifts away from higher order thinking, and you're not going to be open-hearted. And so you end up with a society that gets more and more fearful, more and more aggressive, more and more neglectful of what really brings about our human nature, which is cooperation, compassion, connection. And that means with the natural world, with our communities and the non-kin. So this idea, this Hobbesian world of dog eat dog and competition, that's all what we've created from undermining our wellness informed pathway, our way of becoming human. It takes a while. It takes 30 years at least to become adult. And you need all along the way what I call the evolved nest. We all need to be nested all along the way, especially in early life when our systems are getting established. We're biosocial creatures. Our biology is shaped by our social experience early on. And then our biology is going to react to the situations we're in. So we better have a good beginning. And then we need to maintain that supportive nestedness throughout our lives so that we maintain that cooperative, compassionate nature.
And yeah, and that's both amongst ourselves and also that nestedness that we find when we watch a robin in the grass, or we see a star in the sky, or we feel the cold air coming off the downhill of a mountain, and being put in touch with that. Certainly we know that nature scenes are put in corporate offices that because there's something that automatically does that, but we need to be more conscientious about learning from nature. I know that Derek, you from the years ago told a story about your own experience with some of the bears or the wolves in your neighborhood.
The coyote.
Well, there's that. And then also I was thinking, you know, when this is a little bit of a long story, but I think it's pretty interesting that I grew up in Colorado and I saw coyotes all the time. And then when I was 17, I went to this summer science training program in engineering for a whole bunch of nerds from across the country at University of Southern California. And at one point, we all went on a camping trip, and most of the kids were from cities, and they were making plans for what to do if a coyote attacked them. And I was just laughing. It's like, this is crazy, because I mean, coyotes are not going to attack you. You'll probably hear some, but you're not going to see any. And if you do see one, it'll be a long ways away, et cetera. And then we went to the ocean, and this was a couple years after Jaws came out. And everybody else, they were California kids for the most part. And so they were at the ocean all the time. I had almost never been to the ocean, and I was terrified of sharks because I had not grown up with that. And now that's half the story. The other half of the story is I was doing a talk at some sort of farm school somewhere in the Northeast. And it's a school for teenagers. And then they also had a working farm that the kids worked on when they weren't doing school things. And I grew up around cows and horses. And so we go out in the cows and horses, and I'm just, you know, walking all among them. And if they're, you know, if they're really crowded together and I need to get to the other side, I just sort of push my way through them. No big deal. Totally used to it. And then we get to the pig pasture. And I did not grow up around pigs. And we threw in some watermelons, which they crushed with their mouths. And then they said, hey, do you want to get in and pet the pig? It's like, no way. I am not getting in there. They'll crush my head the same way. And they were just laughing at me saying, look, Derek, the only thing they'll do is the only way they might hurt you is by, you know, sitting on your lap and crushing you because they want petted. And the thing is, what I'm talking about is early experience. Is that clear with my story here?
Yeah.
Another thing that it brings up is the concept of fear. In that passage that I read, he started out by talking about how there's no, you know, there's comfort with the natural world. We have stories in the book about people saying how when they were 5 or 6 years old, they were sent out into the dark forest, which most people today would think would be child abuse, to find their spirit. And so whether you're afraid of a coyote and someone else is afraid of a shark, or someone is afraid of a pig, this concept of what is a rational fear and what is not a rational fear, but a learned fear, is what makes us hyper-suggestible to the colonial language that we hear. And of course, this is what, you know, my cat fawn connection is all about. The idea of concentration activated transformation being that hypnosis that during the first 5 years we are in, and the use of indigenous worldview approaches to fear, authority, words, and nature. So I think that also comes out, that is the early childhood exposure and assumptions that make us be afraid of something that we shouldn't be, but also the idea that we are a fear-based culture, and the dominant worldview is a fear-based worldview that allows for that.
So you've been very clear about this, but I don't think it can be emphasized enough. What, from both of your perspectives, what are the implications and effects of living in a fear-based culture? And I know this is too broad, and I know, again, you've already said this, but it cannot be said enough times. Well, I'm going to back up just a little bit. That one of the things I've written about, and that I'm writing about in a book I'm working on now, and I'll write about probably in every book till I die, is I think that the entire culture, the dominant culture, I think that its economics, its philosophy, its epistemology, everything is basically manifestations of complex post-traumatic stress disorder. And we have an entire culture that is completely controlled by PTSD, complex PTSD. And we can get into that or not if you want. But my point is, I think this, and of course, complex PTSD is really based around having been in situations where you're out of control. And over a long time, that's the difference between PTSD and complex PTSD, is one of them is a one-time incident. You're in an earthquake, somebody shoots you, you know, one time. And complex is when you're actually held captive, as in victims of domestic violence, political prisoners, or any prisoners, or being raised in an entirely fear-based and hierarchical culture. So can you talk about the differences between you hit the worldview thing, but Four Arrows, if you want to hit this harder, the whole worldview, if you want to focus on that word too, that's fine. But
I'd like Darsha to talk about the, you know, because she's an expert in understanding the historical and long-term nature of PTSD. And maybe Darsha, you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, let me start. Thanks. Complex PTSD, we've got it instituted in the way we raise children. You leave babies alone, boom, you're traumatizing them. You leave them to cry, more trauma. Their brain is now oriented to disconnection. They don't feel connected. They feel like they're in the abyss. And we somehow think that's fine. You know, you got to have control over these little creatures or they'll dominate your life, is the myth. And so you end up with children that are already, and then if you circumcise them, oh, even worse, right? Because their first experience of sexuality is trauma and pain and violence. And they carry that into their it's engraved in their bodies, in their brains. And so we end up with people who are already have the complexity of the complex PTSD. And then the parents or adults want to keep making kids afraid. That's what they think they need to do to control them. And it's completely opposite of what the native communities do around the world traditionally before they got colonized. And the Jesuits told them, yes, you have to spank your child and you're beat your wife or you're not a good man. Before all that, the common way of raising children was to honor their needs, meet their needs, to unilaterally initially give a gift of whatever they needed, breast milk for years. Touch and caring and delighting in them and enjoying being with them. We have that kind of opposite way of attitude towards kids, you know, minimize their needs. Oh, don't let them bother you. All that has now created a society that's trauma inducing. And we're on that pathway and it gets passed on generation to generation, psychologically, socially, but also epigenetically. We're changing the gene expression. So people who have had their parents have gone through trauma, they are likely to be more anxious because their genetic makeup has been triggered in that direction. So it's really going to take a lot of work to move back into being the kind of wellness informed and wellness practicing kind of society. And we have ideas for that in the book.
Right. And you really nailed it, Darsha, and combining both that and referring to the long-term epigenetics. You know, I've had doctoral students that have looked at seven generations of boarding school, phenomenon causing trauma. But to get to the worldview part of that, if you think about it, just take it, maybe people in the audience can be doing this. I'm going to just read some of the common dominant worldview manifestations, keeping in mind that we're not talking here in a strict binary sense, that we are on a continuum between the nature-based original baseline worldview that was non-hierarchical for most of the time, except during buffalo hunts when different people were named, for example, and the way that all of our systems are today, our education, our community.
Wait.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, but I think this is a hugely important point because there are a lot of sort of anarchist types who are against all forms of hierarchy. And I want to say two things about that. One is, I love what Noam Chomsky said about it, that yes, there are times, like if he is walking with a great-grandchild and the great-grandchild begins to walk into the road, he said, not only will I override that child's desire to walk into the road, but I will physically restrain that child. So there are, and he says, the question is the hierarchy defensible and is the use of coercion? In this case, kid, you know, if the kid's like a year and a half or 2 years or however old the toddler is and they're going to walk in traffic, of course you grab them. Or if they're going to touch a hot stove, then anyways, that's one thing. And the other is some people taught me how to hunt when I lived in Spokane. And the joke I always say is that I was a terrible hunter. The only thing I ever got was lost. And when we would go hunting, when we're in the truck, everybody is even and we're all on the same level. The moment we get out of the truck and they hand me the gun, I do what they say because they're expert hunters and I'm completely inexperienced. So this is just an example of, I think it is appropriate, the buffalo hunt thing made me think of it. Of course, you're going to listen to the people with experience in that perspective, especially when you're doing something that could get you trampled or could get you, you know, that there are life and death considerations here.
Exactly. You know, and it's not a coincidence that Noam, endorsed two of my indigenous worldview books. And in one of them, he actually said that, and if we do not grasp this material and this understanding of what a few indigenous cultures still remember and all did before, that we are doomed. I mean, it's a direct quote from Noam. So, and you're right. You know, that's why it's. I've had a lot of good liberal friends, a lot of good progressive friends that listen to your show, even that will not look at the worldview chart because they think it is a rigid binary. Well, that's because the dominant worldview in which they live is considered to be by scholars a binary worldview. So to look at this binary and with indigenous perspectives, which is a non-binary worldview, we have to allow it to create dialogue and not stifle it, like the original science versus religion use of a worldview might have done. But if we look at the precepts, because they're interdependent, and it's not just one thing. This isn't looking at a technology or a strategy. If we look, and I'll just read, you know, a few of the 40. We only did 28 in the book. I'll just read a few and be thinking about, could these happen without a degree of fear? Rigid hierarchy is one of them. Okay. And so you brought up the fact that, well, we are going to have hierarchy in times when there's a concern, which is a type of fear, that we're not going to be able to bring buffalo home for the community to survive if we don't have an expert leader on this hunt, or that someone would get hurt. So there's that continuum between hierarchy and non-hierarchy. But in our systems, hierarchy rules everything from education to corporate work, whereas in the Lakota tradition, when that person was assigned, a different person that with experience was assigned for each hunt. So it wasn't the same person. And then when the hunt was over, we went back to a non-hierarchical system. But we could look at that with hierarchy, with living without strong social purpose as a relation to fearfulness, with the focusing on self and personal gain instead of community welfare, materialism versus non-materialism, seeing Earth as an unloving it compared to seeing all systems as sentient, competition to feel superior as opposed to competition to develop positive potential. And I'm just on the first seven, right? We can go all through all 40 of them, and we can make that same argument in terms of the interconnectedness. So I think this is certainly an important part of the topic. And there are ways for us to overcome it by using some metacognition to say, well, why am I thinking what I'm thinking? Why am I afraid of the coyote? And then having an honest dialogue about that, seeing what words were used, so that we go fawn, F-A-W-N. We look at what's the fear behind it, what words were used to create that, and what do we still use, and on whose authority. And then we find out how truthful is what it is that we're experiencing, and what can we learn from nature, right? And using that process of self metacognition on the source of our beliefs and fears, and things that are at some level we know not working, and how to transform by using simple techniques of self-hypnosis, which is what ceremony is. And that's why indigenous peoples have done ceremonies.
One of the key differences, in my view, is that the indigenous perspective or kinship worldview honors the sovereignty, the dignity, the agency of every entity. So that means the tree, the plant, the coyote, they all have their purpose, their own, you know, life way. Why are you going to go and interfere? You wouldn't do that. That's harming. That's coercive. You just avoid that completely. It's wrong in the indigenous perspective. And I'm reminded of an anthropology friend who said she conducted research with the Hadza, and they were doing this same kind of dilemma all over the world, apparently. And they had a frog that was in a tree. There's this frog in a tree. And look, there's a pile of rocks over there. What will you do? And the two Hadza women, she mentioned, she interviewed, they said, "What? How should I know? The frog's in the tree. They want to be there." And then the other one said, "Is that an American frog? An African frog would never go in the tree." You know, I mean, it's like they had a sense of the, you know, where they were, a sense of relationships and understanding of how things worked, where they live, and honoring the life ways of everything there. And that's, you know, the dominant worldview is like, oh, I'm just going to come in and mow down the forest and put up a, you know, parking lot, whatever it is, as if there's no life there. So this idea, the sensibility towards sentience, which is something that just got erased from the European view in the last, hundreds of years in particular, but over time, longer than that, thousands of years, enslaving plants and animals, right, to domesticate and keep them under control, so to feed humans. So it's really a significant basic difference of understanding and sensing and feeling the livingness of the world around you, wherever you are, and honoring that life.
Beautifully said. I would love to tell a little story, Derek, that represents this. Can I?
Oh, please.
So I was running a residential treatment program for troubled youth, staff secured. And we had an American Indian student who had been in a lot of trouble, created a lot of problems, and had been arrested, etc. And we took him with about seven other young boys, blindfolded them and brought them up to a high peak in the state that we were in. And we blindfolded them so that they would not escape. They wouldn't know where we were, how to get back. And this young boy, one of the things that he had done when he was on the reservation, he used to just take his 22 out and shoot rock chucks, just shoot them up in the hills and not eat them or anything, but just shoot them. And he had gotten in trouble for actually being not a shooter, but in a car of a drive-by shooting. So we're there and we told them that we were just going to help when they asked us, but they had to survive for a week. And we had given them some training on things. And for this boy, I'll try to make the story short. There was a rock chuck about 100 feet above us on a rock, maybe 30 meters away. And it kept coming out of its little cave and looking around and going back in. And this boy started telling everybody how if he had a 22, he'd be able to pop that son of a gun. And so I told him, I said, you know, when you did that, were you eating them? He said, nah, we were just shooting them. You know, it was fun to do. And I said, well, you know, we're going to have some meat to survive here this week. Why don't you go up and get that for food? And he said, well, I don't have a 22. I said, well, I know you don't. So what are you going to do? And he said, I don't know. What would you do? And then the kids all talked about it. And somebody said, well, you could sit next to the cave with a hard piece of wood. And when he comes out, you could bang him. So that's what he went up to do. And he was up there throughout the day, overnight, because we told him he couldn't come down without it. And the next day, we could watch him with the binoculars. And you could see that chuck would come out. And he would come out, the boy would swing at it and hit the ground and was getting frustrated. You could see him hit the rock wall a couple of times and kick the ground, and you could hear him cussing. And then he kept at it. And then once that chuck came out, and he was just in perfect stealth, and he got it before it went back in. And we watched what happened. He cried like a baby and looked at it, held it, and it changed his life. It changed his life. Learning that all the lessons that we don't have to tell anybody what they are, they could probably pick them up.
So, Darsha, did you want to say something?
No, it brought tears to my eyes. We all need experiences like that, and children from the time they're babies need to be out in the wild nature as much as possible and let them find their way. We all wayfind through our experiences, and children need to build that receptive intelligence to feel connected, which they'll naturally develop if we allow it and not warn them away and say, oh, it's dangerous, oh, don't do that, all that stuff. Puts them on the wrong path, the path away from the nature connection.
Yeah, and when that boy saw the sentience in that animal and the wisdom and the outsmarting of him, it was a totally different creature. And life does eat life. We're getting eaten by bugs now, and we have to eat plants and whatever. But once you recognize this interconnectedness and that all is spiritual and all is sentient, everything takes on different ways, whether it be about empathy or the use of words or contact or emphasis on responsibility versus rights and self-knowledge and, nature is dangerous. All these concepts that we talk about, they all start to take shape in an interdependent way.
So two things. One of them is that this reminds me of a story by Charlotte Perkins. I never can remember. Gilman or Gilmore? Yellow Wallpaper. It's not that story, but she's a 19th century writer. Charlotte Perkins Gilman, I think. Anyway, she talks about how the Buddha went out into the world and saw that everybody was killing each other, and that's not good. And she changed a couple words, and it changed everything, which is she went out into the world, and she saw that everybody was feeding each other. And that changed really how I perceive the world, that the salmon are feeding the forest, and then the forest is feeding the salmon. That's and beautiful. It's an entirely different perspective than this, as you said, dog eat dog, nature's red in tooth and claw. And yeah, people, non-human people, human people, we all die and we all feed each other in the end. But, and yes, we can be scared in that moment. And our nerve can fail. And, my mom was 86 when she died, and she had asked a friend, a doctor friend, will you help me die? And what she meant is, will you get me something that will help me kill myself before the cancer's too bad? But that's not how he took it. He took it, will you help me in that process? Anyway, the point is, then she entered terminal delirium, and he said he would help. She entered terminal delirium, and then he comes down from Washington State, shows up, and she's in a bad way. She's in terrible pain. She's in everything else. And when he showed up, she was, not really coherent. But as soon as he said, hi, my mom's name was Mary. Hi, Mary. This is John. I'm here. I'm here. She immediately looked at me and put her hand over her mouth. And the point is, even at that stage, life still wants to live. But that doesn't mean that what I'm trying to say is, yes, of course, the gazelle runs away from the cheetah, but that's not. But that doesn't mean that it spends. Everybody seems to think that non-humans, especially prey animals, spend their entire lives terrified. And I just don't think that's true.
Right? No, it's not true at all. The playfulness, the joy, the creativity. I mean, we've got pufferfish lined up and down my beach out here from the netting. But if you ever look at the beautiful mandalas that a male pufferfish makes to attract a mate, you'd be amazed, right? And so that's important. And also, animals, we can learn from them about how they die. They will fight full tilt until the finish, but then at the finish, their spirits are completely ready to go. And indigenous people, we sing our death song. I have people practice it all the time because we practice living, but we don't practice dying. And fear of death leads to a fear of life. So, next time you take an ice cold shower in a cold day, Derek, before you turn on that cold water, just imagine that that's your unexpected moment or your expected moment of passing through, and that you can just allow yourself to sing your death song, or to be in that state of realizing you are a spirit inhabiting a body. And Ray Moody's work on near death experiences, they're all very, very beautiful, and I experienced one myself. So I think it's important to practice so we don't have that fear of even with this the what we call pain.
A very moving World War I story that I read was, there was a troop transport coming up from Africa with a bunch of African soldiers to fight in World War I, and it got torpedoed or it had some problem, was going down, and it was all made of indigenous people from Southern Africa, and as it was going down, they all started singing their death song together. Mm-hmm.
Oh. Yeah, I think and, it's probably true that the fear of death in the dominant worldview is a foundational reason for our fear of life and the defensive mechanisms that we put forward, our fear of doing things and our fear of nature.
And part of the reason for that is because we forgot how to be in the moment, present. What's called polysemy or polymorphism, the ability to take multiple perspectives, to feel like you're in the web of life right now, very full life. You know, it's the trees are right here and they're communicating with me. And, you know, this spider is here and I'm in my body, which is miraculous. And what happened over the course of civilization is that viewpoint got narrowed down and kind of discarded when the left brain, the left hemisphere, took over with its linear, progressive kind of logical thinking. And when you're in that mindset, the future, you're always thinking about the future and then the past and you're scared and death is coming. Ah! And so Marvin Bram and others talk about, you know, the importance of getting back to our full capacity to be here and now and connected.
So we have about 5 or 6 minutes left. And can you talk about what people, I'm sorry if this is too cliche a way to end, and if you have a better way to end, that's fine. But can you talk about what people who have been raised in this culture can do to start to reconnect? Somebody who is, 61, or somebody who is 53 and or 28, whatever. What can they do to start to change, to start to experience the different world and to change their attitude toward nature, death, everything?
I did an experiment that was published a couple of years ago on, we called it the ecological attachment. We were trying to increase it and in college students. And so we've developed from that successful experiment. Yes. developed a set of practices, 28, ecoattachment.dance, if you go there. It's just one little nudge a day to get you back connected in your body, connected to the natural world around you. And I think just little things like that's one way to start. There's other things at evolvenest.org. Our whole book is about trying to nudge people towards really embracing their ancestral kinship worldview.
Yeah, I think that the plug for the book is a good timing on this, because that's why we wrote the book, Derek, is so the 61-year-old and the 18-year-old and the 84-year-old could actually have an opportunity to see and, first of all, read these powerful poetic speeches of indigenous voices, but then to see how we can practically bring that into our life. This is in the DNA of everyone. All of the indigenous worldview precepts you can find in all of the religions, you can find in all of the philosophies of all cultures. They have not made it into the mainstream because of the things that we've been talking about. And that includes the phenomenon of self-hypnosis, a concept that has been Hollywoodized and misunderstood. But also being able to have this perspective on learning from the cockroach in your bathroom or the weed coming out of the concrete or whatever. And once you begin to read our book, you begin to have the opportunities, you see them all around.
So I would love to do an interview with both of you again, a different interview about specifically about the self-hypnosis. Do you think we could fill an entire show with that?
Yes.
Oh, I definitely think so. Yeah, it's just the least talked about idea, and the idea that's ceremony is about that. That's what ceremony was. If somebody wanted to be more generous or hunt better, we did ceremonies to give appreciation or to imagine. Because all hypnosis is believing deeply in an image and using when you're in a lower brainwave frequency. And it's been taken over by the people in power, the Rush Limbaughs of the world, and and the Fox Newses of the world. And so we need to understand what Indigenous people knew for most of human history.
And children spend most of their first years in the hypnotic state. So everything they experience is like being hypnotized into how to act, how to feel, how to be in the world. So it's really important to understand it.
So, and I know that this is unfair because we're still in this interview, but two things I want to talk about when we do that will be, one is, I remember hearing an interview with some rock stars who went to Mongolia, and they were, both the interviewer and the rock star were both really excited at how the power cords had gotten into the bodies of the people in Mongolia and the young people in Mongolia. And they were really excited about this, how music can be universal. And I was horrified because this is, I mean, you're opening them up like this, and then you're sending some message about, you know, I was on my baby and my baby was on me, or, you know, some sort of rock lyric that is just, that's a very powerful tool or I'm on the highway to hell. You know, that's one thing.
I have a chapter in Primal Awareness about that, and that the power of music, and it, just like anything else, can be misused. And both Darsha and I are musicians, and we understand music. But if you look at, you can march into war, or you can march into meditation. And so it's just like everything else. It even music is dependent upon the worldview.
Totally. Let's do that interview. But in the meantime, what I would like for either one or both of you to do, it doesn't matter, to do to end this interview, I would like to end it with a voice from the book. So if you could just either grab a random one or one that you think is great. And either one, if you want to do just one, that's fine. If you want to do both, if you each want to do one, that's fine too.
Do you have your book, Darsha?
Yes, I do. How about Kimmerer?
There you go. Go for it.
All right. Let me find her here. Robin Wall Kimmerer, botanist, PhD, who integrates Indigenous perspectives in modern science. Here's the quote. Collectively, the Indigenous canon of principles and practices that govern the exchange of life for life is known as the honorable harvest. They are rules of sorts that govern our taking, shape our relationships with the natural world, and rein in our tendency to consume, that the world might be as rich for the seventh generation as it is for our own. The details are highly specific to different cultures and ecosystems, but the fundamental principles are nearly universal among peoples who live close to the land. The guidelines for the honorable harvest are not written down or even consistently spoken of as a whole. They are reinforced in small acts of daily life. But if you were to list them, they might look something like this. Know the ways of the ones who take care of you, so that you may take care of them. Introduce yourself. Be accountable as the one who comes asking for life. And she's talking about plants and animals. Ask permission before taking. Abide by the answer. Never take the first. Never take the last. Take only what you need. Take only that which is given. Never take more than half. Leave some for others. Harvest in a way that minimizes harm. Use it respectfully. Never waste what you have taken. Share. Give thanks for what you have been given. Give a gift in reciprocity for what you have taken. Sustain the ones who sustain you, and the earth will last forever.
Wow.
And do you want to end with that, or 4 hours? Do you want to do one?
No, I think that's perfect. That's why I said Matakwayasana. That's how we end our prayers, saying we're all related.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your work in the world, and thank you for bringing the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guests today have been Darsha Narvaez and 4 Arrows. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.